recording. Anyway, Boris picked this rather general title for another talk I'm giving called How Do Biologists Think? And I'm not sure I can really address that because I don't know how anybody thinks. But here we have a limited title is Do We Understand Lambda Phage? And obviously we wouldn't be here, I don't think, if the answer was yes. So I think to understand why the answer is no, I think we need to start out by talking about what we know about lambda in general terms, and as a sort of gene regulatory problem. And so I think what I'll do first is describe the lambda life cycle, which will give you some ideas of why we think of lambda as an interesting gene regulatory system. It was really the first complex regulatory system was worked out in any kind of mechanistic detail. Once I describe the circuitry, that sort of poses some obvious questions for how we might want to address a mechanistic understanding of how it works, and I'll talk about our current understanding of that. Then I'll say where Kim can pitch in at any time, of course. I'll say where we think this description is lacking, and just to anticipate it's lacking in a lot of quantitative aspects that you guys are interested in, and in particular its predictive power in various ways. So I think what I'll do then is talk a little bit about what it is we'd like to know, what kinds of problems we want to address, both short-term and long-term, and talk about our studies that address some of these problems and just sort of the current status of those. Okay, so lambda is an example of what's called a temperate virus or temperate phage. And all that term means is that it has two alternative lifestyles when it infects an E. coli cell. So if lambda infects an E. coli cell, it injects its DNA into the cytoplasm of the cell. And then that infected cell can follow either of two pathways which are mutually exclusive. The first pathway is probably familiar to you, the kind of thing that Kostya Severinov talked about last week. It's called the lytic pathway. And if it follows this, the goal of this pathway is to make a bunch of viruses, typically about 100 new viruses from that infected cell. And when it does that, it expresses a program of gene expression like Kostya talked about, where it expresses some early genes in a timed way, later some middle genes, and then later on some late genes. These middle genes, a lot of them are involved in things like DNA replication so that it can copy more of the DNA, make many copies of the DNA. The late genes are mostly involved in production of the mature viruses, which are often called virions. So that would be heads and tails and other proteins that are needed to package the viral DNA into the mature virus particles. Also, some proteins involved in lysing the cell. Again, Kostya talked about that. And so the end result of all these pattern of gene expression and DNA replication is 100 new lambda viruses that are then released into the environment to go look for other cells. Yeah.
How much control does lambda have on this number one?
On what? The 100? Oh, no, I don't know if anybody's done this for lambda. For other, these experiments are quite tedious, as you'll see when I describe them. For other viruses, like T4, I think, is the one that was done for, that number varies quite broadly. I mean, people, you know, aliquot out, let's say, 1,000 aliquots with maybe 100 infected cells, and then they titer all of them, and then they get a number. I don't know what the distribution is, but it's quite broad.
Variation coming from different people in different environments, sort of wanting to do different things, or is this sort of coming from
I don't think anybody really knows that, but they're all genetically the same. So, and their environment ought to be the same as best as anybody can control it. So I don't think that that number's, I mean, it's an average number. And I don't know what the distribution is. I don't know if anybody's done that for Lambda. Yeah.
Do you just keep a single virus and infect a single bacterial cell and then...
Yes.
Does it happen in multiple...
So if you infect a cell with several Lambdas, that favors the other response I'll say in a minute, but a certain fraction of those cells still can follow this pathway. Okay?
So one Lambda doesn't other
No, not for Lambda. There's other viruses that have that kind of exclusion property, but not Lambda.
One Lambda gets integrated into the genome, and much later someone else comes in. Usually that integrates, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about the lysogenic state, and then that'll be a lot clearer.
But at the same time, if there are four guys in, then that stops that.
Well, it. If you have a large number of phage infecting a cell, let's say 5 to 10, then the lysogenic pathway that I'll describe in a minute is a lot more likely than if you have a single one infecting a cell. And one could try to rationalize that, but I don't know how good those arguments are, yeah.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
What's the lifetime of Lambda?
Oh, what? How long does this take? About 60 minutes? Okay, so that's a complicated question, but I don't know the answer. I can't give you a number, but different viruses have quite different properties. Somebody mentioned this last week a little bit. There's an infamous virus called T1 that's apparently just about bulletproof. It's very resistant to drying. When it's dry, it's very resistant to heating, and so if you get it in your lab, it just sort of contaminates everything. And you have to make all your strains resistant to it. Lambda's not like that. But there's a whole range of, should I call it robustness? I guess not. Of toughness, I guess, would be. As Kostya said, some viruses have the protein, so the head of the virus is a repeating capsid structure with, I don't know how many, a few hundred molecules of protein. And in some viruses, that is kind of cross-linked, like or topologically linked, like chainmail, and that makes it much tougher to agents that might disrupt it. Lambda, I think, is kind of a wimp compared to most viruses, to many viruses, and this came out when people started worrying 30 years ago about whether recombinant DNA was safe or not, and they checked to see how long Lambda would last in typical environments, and I think it didn't last as long as a lot of other viruses. But it's possible to get other viruses that, again, Kostya talked about this a little bit, that have all the gene regulatory circuitry of Lambda but have different heads and tails, and they might be a lot tougher. Yes, yeah. You have a question? Oh, let's talk about that a little bit later, okay? First, I want to get the sort of the overall phenomenology straight, and then we can talk about what regulates it, okay? So let's talk about the lysogenic pathway. This is an alternate pathway in which the virus actually can set up housekeeping in the host. And when it does that, it integrates its DNA into the DNA of the host, and when the host multiplies, the DNA of the virus is just copied just like all the other host DNA. I mean, it's not a different color or anything. It's just treated by the host replication machinery as more DNA. So it's another way for the virus to make more copies of itself. And when it follows this pathway, an important regulatory protein called C1 is made in ways I'll talk about in a bit. C1 is made, and C1 acts to turn off all these, the early gene expression that would let it follow the lytic pathway. The other thing that happens, as I said, is that the DNA is integrated into the host DNA that follows a particular kind of site-specific recombination where a particular enzyme is made by the virus that works with some host proteins to cause a very specific recombination event at a specific place in both of these DNAs, and the end result is that the virus is inserted into this so-called attachment site in the E. coli DNA. And so here would be the lambda after that's happening. So two things have to happen. The lytic genes have to be turned off by the C1 protein, and the lambda DNA has to be integrated into the DNA of the host in order for it to be propagated indefinitely. Okay. And so as a result of this, one sets up a very stable state of the system called the lysogenic state. And this, you've heard this kind of state referred to a lot as an epigenetic state. It's the same genes as you have here, though they're arranged in a somewhat different way because it's integrated. But basically, it's a regulatory state of the system that's extremely stable. And we'll get into a lot later, and Ken will talk about what the stability of this state is. So that state can persist indefinitely, but it can also be switched from this lysogenic state to the lytic state. And the way that works is by inducing a host system called the SOS system. And I don't want to talk about that, it's something we've worked on for a long time. But the SOS system basically is triggered by anything that damages the host DNA, like UV radiation or treatment with mutagens or carcinogens. And what that does is to activate a host protein called RecA, which then interacts with this C1 protein. And the result of that interaction, which I'm not going to try to describe in any detail, is that C1 is cut in half and inactivated, and that trips the switch. So for the cell to stay in this this epigenetic state, this lysogenic state, it has to have C1, and we'll talk a lot more about where the C1 comes from in a little bit. If you destroy the C1, then the lytic genes can be expressed, and there are mechanisms that it's thought cause this switch to become irreversible, so that it's possible then for the SOS system to cause this switch of state from lysogenic to lytic state, and then they just follow, the cells just follow this lytic pathway after that.
SOS and RecA are both host proteins.
Are what?
Host proteins belong to the E. coli.
Yeah. The SOS is not a gene, it's the description of the regulatory system that the E. coli has. That's right. So just to put a pitch in for my own work, it doesn't really cut it. It stimulates it to cut itself in half. We can get off on that, but that's a whole separate topic. And
that, is there some reason that the coli can't develop a rec protein that won't guard the lytic pathway? Would be then intrinsically,
resistant to induction. Okay, well, so this gets to a broader question of why does E. coli have something to help the phage out? It's not for that purpose, obviously. And what it does, the SOS system isn't there to let lambda induce, it's there to let the host protect its own genes.
Yeah, and C1 is not a host protein, one can imagine a specific
right.
specificity issue there, where one could make them to continue to do the job in the SOS response. But
specifically, your crazy question, is the way RecA acts on within the SOS system on Lexa related to the way it is acting on C1?
It probably is very similar, but it might be, so again, I don't want to go too far down this path, but it's thought that what the Lexa, or, so I'm sorry, Lexa the reason for the SOS system is to, the reason the RecA gets activated in this way is to cleave an E. coli protein called Lexa. That regulates a bunch of DNA repair genes and other functions that help repair the host DNA. And so lambda is kind of a freeloader for that. So what's being suggested is perhaps the host could evolve in such a way that the REC A would be able still to have a normal ability to stimulate Lex A cleavage, but couldn't do it for lambda repressor. Sorry?
What C1 does is the host protein, right?
No, C1's a lambda protein, yeah.
I think it's a game that at least you never win, or right? The virus can just change it. Whatever you do, it just changes.
Well,
that's
I'm not.
A very hard selection, I think, to do. It's more likely, I think, in evolution that E. coli will have its own C1, that it will just maybe consistently express if it is resistant to a lambda.
Well, it would have to acquire the gene, though. Okay, but there's lots and lots of other lambda-like phages out there in nature. You know, I don't know how many. Each one of them has its own C1, and well, I don't know the answer to these questions. All I can say is that's what we find. Is lambda doesn't? I mean, E. coli doesn't have its own C1. So what's in it for the host to have the capability of getting these phages into them? That's a good question. I don't know about lambda. Some phages, similar to lambda, carry proteins, express proteins, even in the lysogenic state that help the host. For example, some of the, somebody help me out here. I shouldn't be asking physicists for help about biology. I think it's cholera toxin is carried on a phage, and so that confers a selective advantage to the host, for example. So what happens, what mechanistically happens to the REC-A? Is that the question?
Right. So for example, you can use irradiation.
Yeah.
So from this point, how REC-A gets activated?
So it's thought that what happens is that when the replication fork meets the site of damage, it stops, and there's some kind of form of DNA, probably single-stranded DNA, at that site. And the REC-A binds to that single strand of DNA, some form of DNA that's not normally present in large amounts in the cell. Activated REC-A stimulates the cleavage of both of these proteins. Yeah, is that what you're asking? So REC-A is not a protease itself. We call it a coprotease, because it stimulates a reaction, but the active site for that reaction is in the repressors, not in REC-A. It's a fine distinction. Yeah.
I guess there is no sequence similarity between CI and REC-A.
There's some, but most of it has to do with the mechanism of this self-cleavage reaction.
With convergence.
I don't know about that. I doubt that. If you look at the structures of them, they're extremely similar. But it could well be that the binding site on these proteins where REC-A binds is different. And that's something we're looking into now. It's hard to.
The theory is on the virus hijacked, let's say.
REC-A, yeah.
Let's say, at some point.
Oh.
Well, I guess the interesting point here is, as I mentioned, there are several different versions of C1 in different.
Well, they all do this cleavage reaction, so they're similar in that respect. So these, I mean, okay, let me, oh, that's, I don't know, they're not all the same distance, but they're, I don't know how to answer that question. Well, let me just describe the domain organization of these proteins, and maybe that'll help. So there's a DNA binding domain, and this is what interacts with the DNA. And the protein works as a dimer. Most of the dimerization interactions are in this domain. So the specificity for DNA binding is in a different part of the protein than the specificity for the cleavage reaction. And this domain that I'm calling the dimerization domain is also the one that does the specific cleavage, and I can show anybody that's interested the crystal structure of that. And that then attacks in a unimolecular reaction, not when it's a dimer, but it attacks the linker between these two, and so it separates the DNA binding domain from the dimerization domain, and that's how it's inactivated.
And C1 does its repressor
Okay, so now let's talk, so now we're starting to get into mechanisms, and I'll get to that right now, unless there are more questions about. So this is sort of the basic life cycle. And so there's a number of interesting questions here, and I want to take them in reverse order. First is, what causes a decision to be made between the lytic and lysogenic state? Unfortunately, we can't give you a totally satisfactory answer to that. Another is, what causes the lysogenic state to be very stable? The lytic state can be made stable under special circumstances, though it's not ordinarily needed to be extremely stable because everything's over in an hour. And then the last mechanistic question or regulatory question is, how does it switch? And we've been talking about that to a certain extent. Yeah.
There's one more question about the general lifestyle. Is the SOS the only system that triggers, or is it the most steady?
It's the main. Okay, so if you knock out the SOS system by mutation, this is, we'll talk, Kim and I will talk about this later. If you knock it out by mutation, there's hardly any, it hardly ever breaks down. And I don't know of a lot of detailed studies that people have done to.
Knocking out REC A?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Could REC A be activated by high cyclic AMP or?
Oh, I see. Okay, I don't. What, from what we know about what activates REC-A, I don't think that's very likely. Okay, so, I mean, there's a wide range of treatments that can activate it, the SOS system. But it's thought they're all related to DNA damage.
Physiology, you know. If you starve bacteria, then not know to, you know, like it's infected.
No. So let me just make a general point about this, which I don't want to short circuit this discussion, but talk about evolutionary pressures is a little, or why is it the way it is, or what are the evolutionary forces on it, what are adaptive, is a little bit complicated to talk about in this case, for E. coli in general, because we don't study it in anything like its natural environment. Natural environment would be in the gut, where it's sort of a feast and famine regime, or out in a stream somewhere in some dilute aqueous environment. We study it in the lab for sound reasons in very rich growth medium where it's growing extremely rapidly, exponentially, with a half-life of 20 or 30 minutes. And the reason for doing that is it's easy to reproduce from my lab to your lab, and it's easy to reproduce from one day to the other. It's a system it's a situation that's easy to reproduce. But there's no pretense, I mean, people don't tend to talk about this, but there's no pretense that we're studying in its natural environment. So if you wanted to talk about selective pressures, number one, you'd have to study it in the natural environment, and number two, you'd have to find a way of sort of integrating what you find in different environments over the whole life cycle of the virus, and I don't know of anybody that's able to do that, okay? Let's get to, yes.
Slightly different from getting out of the lysogenic.
That's right.
State.
Let's get to that after we talk about what involved in this choice, okay? Okay. So, are we done describing the life cycle? Okay. So I've always found it's easier in talking about the circuitry to start with a relatively simple problem of how is this regulatory state stabilized. And as I said, it's not important to stabilize this regulatory state, but it is important for it not to be changing its mind in the middle. And so there are forces, as I'll talk about now, that keep this one from kicking in when this one is being executed. Under special genetic circumstances where you knock out the ability of the virus to proceed down this pathway, the lytic state as a regulatory state can be stable, but that hasn't been studied very much. Okay? And so, although this is more complicated than it was a few years ago, I'll tell you the sort of the current model, and I'll tell you a little bit about the complications that's going to make it more difficult to do computer simulations of this system. Okay, so most of the action in Lambda for regulation takes place in a complicated regulatory region, which I won't draw quite to scale, called the OR region. This region contains a lot of sites where proteins act, and it regulates the expression of two genes. One of those genes is C1 itself. The other one is another regulatory protein called CRO that lies over here. These genes are expressed from two different promoters. One promoter, read in this direction, is called PRM. And I'll tell you what that nomenclature means in a second. The other promoter that reads in this direction is called PR. So just to remind you, a promoter is a place where RNA polymerase binds to initiate transcription. And these promoters partly overlap the operators, and their relationship to these sites is important, as we'll see in a second. So these three boxes here are called operator sites. An operator is just a place where a repressor binds to turn off transcription, although it's more complicated than that in this particular case. So let me just remind you what the nomenclature a little bit. A repressor is defined as a protein that binds to DNA at particular sites and inhibits or turns off or turns down transcription. An activator is something that binds to a particular site and increases the level of transcription from a weak promoter. Is everybody familiar with this nomenclature? I don't want to belabor it. Okay, so we've got three binding sites here, and we've got two proteins that bind our specific DNA binding proteins. And the strange thing about Lambda is that both C1 and CRO bind to both of these sites. So let's talk about CRO first, because it's simpler. So these three sites, I'll just call 3, 2, and 1, just to avoid writing OR over and again. CRO binds to all three of these sites, but the tricky part is that it binds to this site tightly and to these sites more weakly. So what I'm trying to explain now is how the lytic state is stabilized when the cell makes that, infected cell makes that, follows that pathway. First thing that happens when Lambda infects a cell is it makes a little bit of CRO. This poses a problem which we'll address in a minute, but let's just talk about what happens with that little bit of CRO. It binds here, but not to these two sites. You have to get the level be higher to bind to sites 1 and 2. And when it's 20 or 30 fold, something like that. I'm not sure exactly for CRO. Maybe more like tenfold, I think, actually. So what's the consequence when CRO binds here is that it shuts off this PRM promoter and has no effect on its own promoter. And so let's just try to, PR is on because it's not being turned off. PRM is completely off, so there's no way to make C1 now from this promoter. So if you have CRO but no C1, at a later time, you'll have the same state perpetuated because there's no way to make C1 from this regulatory region. There's another way to make it, but let's not get to that yet. Okay, so in other words, if CRO wins, it continues to win. Okay?
There's four promoters in your...
There's two promoters.
Then what those little lines do in the middle?
Okay, I'm sorry. This is the minus 10 and the these are the recognition elements for the RNA polymerase. Sorry. And I put them there to indicate they overlap with these binding sites partly, and that's critical. Okay, so that's CRO anyway. So that's the easy one. If, on the other hand, this virus has, if there's C1 and no CRO in in the cell, then that state can also perpetuate itself in the following way. C1 binds tightly to this site. I'm just going to put numbers that are rough numbers. These are the relative affinities of C1 for these sites. So if this is a dissociation constant, so this is a tight binding site, these are some 25-fold weaker, something like that. Okay? So when C1 binds here, it shuts off PR. And so you could have C1 winning even though it doesn't. Let me just say that C1, the reason it's more complicated is that C1 binds, as I said, this is a weak binding site, but C1 is caused to bind to this site by a phenomenon called cooperative DNA binding. It's an attractive protein-protein interaction that increases the affinity of C1 for this site when C1's bound to the OR1 site. Okay? So although this is a weak intrinsic binding site, it's made to bind tightly by the cooperative interaction. When C1's bound to these two sites, it completely shuts off PR, and it has another effect, which is that it actually activates the expression of PRM, some tenfold or so. So in other words, C1 is not only a repressor, oftentimes people call it lambda repressor, but it's also an activator of its own expression from this rather weak promoter. So there's an element of positive feedback there.
-35 overlap doesn't get in the way of
that. Well, it doesn't. But I think the thinking is that the two proteins, so it's a part of RNA polymerase called sigma, and the sigma is thought to, I think they're thought to come at it from somewhat different sides of the DNA. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer is, but it's not a problem. I mean, it's probably necessary to have it be that way for it to activate, because if you look in the structure, I can show anybody that's interested. Well, this is a low-resolution structure. The part of lambda repressor that touches the sigma is very close to the DNA. There's now a structure for a sigma bound to DNA. There's not a structure for all of these, but they're very close together on the DNA. So it's not a deal like you heard about last week, where some proteins are reaching across and making contact with a site 30 or 50 angstroms away. This is the fine details of the interaction are probably critical in this case. Yeah. So that's a good question. So the question is, how come if there's cooperative binding, why doesn't this site fill up too? And there's a feature of C1 that's not really well understood, but I've kind of indicated it in a very schematic way by having these guys lean toward each other. And that is that the guy in the middle, the dimer in the middle, can only make cooperative interactions with one of the two flanking sites at a time. If you knock this site out by mutation, then it can make a cooperative interaction here fine. So it has to choose between one and the other, and typically it chooses this site because this site's much more likely to be occupied. So it's a bunch of coupled equilibria. You'd have some small fraction of it bound here, but that fraction would be very small in general. I'm going to simplify the way I'm drawing this to say, I'll just draw a blob here. If you have all three bound, then this one could be flipping back and forth. But the thing is, probably the C1 concentration would be low enough that more often you just have this pattern of occupancy. If this happens, then that was the next thing I was going to say. If C1 also binds to site 3, it shuts itself off. So there's a negative autoregulation involved as well, and that keeps the level of C1 from getting to be too high.
C1 binds the palindromic site, or
yeah.
the tandem
These are, well, the, each of these, sorry. Because this site's a tighter binding site than this. I mean, sorry, each of these patterns of occupants. Let's.
When you draw these dumbbells, why are they moving left?
It's just a.
Rather than right.
It's just a schematic way of indicating that it's pairwise.
You don't really want to say that they break symmetry. They're symmetric.
Well, in this diagram, there'd be an axis of symmetry like that. This, yeah, each one by itself.
Each diagram is palindromic.
That's right.
So it has a narrow symmetry.
That's right. But since the one in.
This cartoon suggests that one and two interact, but not two and three, right? By virtue of breaking that symmetry, right? By virtue of beaming over.
Okay, so let's just say it a different way. There's some kind of, I mean, this is sort of like saying we don't understand it. I appreciate it. But there's some kind of steric constraint that prevents this one from being able to contact ones on both sides at the same time.
So how are these based on
DNA? This is 7 base pairs and 6 base pairs. So as I said, if you knock this site out, then it can make a cooperative interaction there. We found. Well, I mean, who knows whether it's DNA bending or protein bending? There's no structural information for the whole protein, so it's a little bit hard to say. So just to pursue that a little bit, we found with a different C1 from another phage called Hong Kong 22, if you have 9 bases between the binding sites, you get the same pattern of occupancy. It's pairwise, but if you move them closer together, and now they're 6 base pairs apart, now it can bind cooperatively to all 3. These are 15. So these are about two plus turns of the helix apart. So here we're moving them closer together, and we're also changing their rotational relationship to each other. So in this case, we imagine them sort of standing up straight like soldiers. I mean, again, it's very schematic. But so I'm not sure what the problem is with breaking symmetry, I guess. I mean, it certainly seems feasible that you could have a protein that had to choose between interacting over here and over here.
The remark is that the symmetry is not broken on the level of the dimer interacting, the single dimer interacting with DNA on a single site. Right? It's somehow broken on the level of organizing cooperatively, right?
Yeah.
The
symmetry is broken in the first place because one is a stronger binder and the other more weaker binder. That's why you have one to the right has a
symmetry. But that does not choose.
But as long as the configuration is
that does not choose left from right.
Okay, why don't we move on? Okay, so this is taken. Okay. Okay. So this is something we can talk about afterward, for those that are interested. Anyway, getting back to the circuitry. So this pattern of occupancy then stabilizes the lysogenic state, because if you have C1, it stimulates its own expression and represses Cro expression. So if C1 wins, it continues to win. Okay? So this, to a first approximation, at least, explains how each of these regulatory states is stabilized. There's a complication that I don't want to get into now that maybe we can talk about later, but let's just say this description is adequate to explain how these regulatory states are stabilized. So you remember I said, however, there's a conundrum here, because the first, when lambda infects a cell, the first thing it does is make some Cro, and so it seems like that's going to perpetuate this state. How would you ever get to a state where you have some C1 and no Cro? Okay, now we need to erase that. So maybe Kim can put it on the other board or something if we want to have it to refer to. C1 got named. This will make more sense in a minute, but I'll tell you. So somebody, my advisor, a guy named Dale Kaiser, for his graduate work, decided he was going to study the process of lysogeny. And so if we plate normal lambda out, did anybody, people know what plates are and plaques are? So if you have a petri dish with a thin layer of agar on the top and some cells in there and they're infected, then the cells grow and the virus grows faster. So if you look at it from the top, the virus eats little holes in the layer of bacteria. I should have brought a plate of this, but I didn't. Normal lambda plaques are cloudy or turbid because lysogens arise in the middle of the plaques and they can grow. And they can continue to grow because even if another lambda infects the cell, like you said, it is repressed by the C1 that's in the cell, so it can't grow. And so that's called superinfection immunity, and the viruses are stable in there. So this is a very typical approach of a geneticist, is you look for a different appearance or phenotype. And what Kaiser did was to look for plaques that were no longer cloudy, but clear. And so he called them C1, C2, and C3, and we'll talk about C2 and C3 in a second. So the C just means clear, pretty simple. I actually don't know what CRO stands for. It had a bunch of different names when it was made.
CRO actually stands for controller, repressor, and other things.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. My favorite acronym like that is there's a kinase called JAK, J-A-K, and it stands for just another kinase. But people call it something different now. It has a much more upscale name now. Okay, anyway, that's what C1 stands for, is just clear, okay? Okay, so you remember I said that when lambda infects a cell, it has these two choices. It can go lytic or lysogenic. How does it decide which way to go? This is where the physiology does seem to be important. If it's going to go lytic, I'm sorry, let me start from a different point. Remember I said the problem is how do you make some C1 if in a cell it's already got some CRO in it? Because I already told you the circuitry said that the CRO turns C1 off. And the answer to that is, let me talk about how that works first, and then we'll talk about the physiology. So the promoter I told you about before was called PRM. Oh, there's another promoter over here called PRE that can make a large amount of C1 soon after infection if it's stimulated by another regulatory protein called C2. So this is the second one. If you don't have C2, it makes clear plaques also. C2 is coded for a gene that's over here, so as soon as you're making CRO, you'll also make some C2. But the tricky part in all this, and it's a part that's not understood for reasons I'll say in a minute, is that C2 is an extremely unstable protein. It's degraded very rapidly by proteases to fragments, and probably the activity of those proteases is controlled in some way that we don't well understand by the physiology of the cell. PRE is another promoter. This is C1 here, sorry. This is CRO. C1, C2 is made here, but it's expressed from a, I'm sorry, I'm not used to these blackboard things. Okay, let me draw this a little differently. It's expressed from a transcript, from the PR transcript that starts there and runs off into the distance. And one of the things that's made from that transcript is C2. If the levels of if the levels of C2 rise to a high value, then C2 can activate PRE. But that's the part that depends on a lot of different physiology in a way that's not understood, is what controls the levels of C2. One thing that controls the levels is if the cell is infected with several viruses, 5 or 10, then there's more C2. There's another protein from over here someplace called C3 that also acts to, let's see, on the protease that degrades C2 is called HFL, and C3 in some way antagonizes the action of HFL. So there's all these sort of interlocking controls that, in a way, sense the physiology of the cell and regulate the level of C2. So if the level of C2 is low, the virus goes lytic. If the level of C2 is lysogenic, is high, then the virus goes lysogenic, even if there's some CRO in the cell. So this overrides the regulation at the OR region that I was talking about before. HFL is a host protein. It's actually two host proteins, or maybe three or four. And you'll appreciate this. They're membrane proteins. And one of them, its business end is in the periplasm, and the other one has its business end in the cytoplasm. And that makes the biochemistry really difficult. So they're not really very well understood, the HFL proteins, what they do. And it's not totally well understood what C3 does to antagonize their action, but I think it's thought that one of them is either a competitive inhibitor of HFL, but I'm not sure about
where
that.
Where is C3 expressed from?
C3 is expressed from another lytic promoter called PL, which later on is extended and expresses C3 from over on the left side. But I don't want to get too far off into the regulation of lytic functions, because that takes a long time to talk about, too.
I'll talk to the side on PLE is a promoter site that will upregulate C1.
Right.
It is from downstream of the CRO gene.
If you're looking in this direction, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing, right. And so C2 goes, one way. Let me talk about the nomenclature. So this is called the PR promoter, R for rightward, because it's read rightward. This is PL for leftward. PRE stands for promoter for repressor establishment. And I'll talk about what that means in a second. PRM is promoter for repressor maintenance. Okay? C2 is transcribed from the PR promoter. This is CRO here. PR is the lytic promoter. It makes CRO, it makes C2. So C2 is always getting made, but if it's unstable, it doesn't have any effect on the system. IHF has some activity over here. I don't know what it does. And DNAA is thought to have some function here by some people, but that hasn't been well worked out, I don't believe.
So the level of C2 is controlled by stability?
Yeah. Well, it might also be controlled by gene dosage, because if you infect with a lot of phage, it stimulates, it favors the lysogenic pathway.
Ordinarily,
if everything is cranking, it's something like 2 minutes, a half-life. This is very hard to study. Sorry? I think the 2 minutes is what happens if you just make C2.
Yeah.
Without all the other control. So if you make C2 off a plasmid, then you don't have C3 and you don't have gene dosage effects. Then that's the half-life, I think, something in that range. So you'd want to stabilize it more than that to favor lysogeny.
Right, but how is it stabilized?
It's stabilized by, the levels can build to high levels by two things. One is having a lot of copies of the C2 gene or a lot of transcripts for it. The other is the C3 acts to inhibit, in some way that's not too well understood, the proteases that degrade C2. So C3 acts, again, to favor the lysogenic. And again, if you knock out either of these, you also get clear plasma.
Is C2 particularly
the protease.
Not
well, I think they are to some extent. They have some specificity.
Yeah,
some specificity, yeah.
I think the argument about there being more C2, okay, isn't a very good argument because you have multiple infections. Yes, you have more C2, but you also have more CRO.
Okay, right? But like I said, if you have CRO, if you make a lot of C1 from PRE, it overrides that high level of CRO.
But what I'm trying to say is that they would grow proportionally if you have multiple infections. The number of CRO.
Okay.
And number of C1. So the increase of lifetime of C2 most probably is a more crucial factor.
Well, I don't agree. The if you have a lot of C1 made from this, I'm sorry, let's say it a different way. If this is the level of C1 in a lysogen, if you do an infection, I don't know the details of this curve, but if you do an infection under conditions where it's going to go lysogenic, you get a huge overshoot of C1 relative to the level in the lysogen. So this high level of C1 probably binds to all the regulatory sites I talked about before and shuts everything off. So even if you have some CRO, C1's still going to bind to all those sites. It'll shut off PRM, it'll shut off PR, okay. It'll shut off PL, and that's going to win.
That's a quantitative question. If you have lots and lots and lots of CRO, you will shut off PRM.
But you're not shutting off PRE, that's the point.
Well, the part that I don't understand very well is if CRO sits at O3, I guess, right? In models, the transcript for PRE is you pretend as if it's not effective, right?
That's what
but
people presume. I don't know that it's been studied.
Lots of things sitting there. I mean, you can interfere with making of.
Any specific DNA binding protein is always coming on and going off the DNA. And so you could have some RNA polymerases waiting, and then when CRO came off, then they would just go by. Usually, but not always. Well, so it's not, I don't know, maybe you know some examples. There aren't very many examples where a repressor can act as a roadblock to an elongating RNA polymerase. And as I understand it, I don't think this is very well understood, what happens when you get a roadblock? I mean, there was a bunch of contentious discussion last week between Richard E. Bright and Konstantin Severinov about this. What happens when you hit a roadblock really depends on where the RNA polymerase is. And these things are very hard to study in vitro because you have to have a system that's homogeneous, and to make it homogeneous you have to stop the RNA polymerase, and then that might affect its behavior. So it's really difficult to analyze. Okay.
John, one other thing that is probably relevant to the discussion is the on and off rates. Not just the affinity, but the off and on rates have a lot to do with whether or not, if a protein has a very high off rate, payoff is very high, then there's a real good chance for RNA polymerase potentially to come in. But if it has a very low off rate, so you can imagine two DNA binding proteins that have the same affinity, but totally different off and on rates. Right? And that makes a lot of difference as to the timing, the kinetics.
They're more in the matter of 1 minute or so,
yeah,
when you agree. Well, it's hard to know what it is in vivo because it's hard to study again. Okay. So the title of this talk is Do We Understand Lambda? So I'd like to sort of start getting at that question now. So I've told you a sort of qualitative description of how all the parts fit together. And so the question is that enough? I mean, it's complicated, and there's a lot of different pieces that fit together. And let's forget about this part because it's not very well understood, and Kim and I aren't going to talk about it. But even leaving that part out, once the decision's been made, do we understand what stabilizes the regulatory states and how they switch from one another, one to the other? I think that's fair to say, I mean, and it's complicated to take all this in, I think it's fair to say that really what I've told you is this kind of a qualitative story. I mean, we could put numbers on how tightly the proteins bind to their various sites. In vitro, it's difficult to relate those to in vivo affinities for various reasons. But even if we knew what they were in vivo, it might not be sufficient, given the description I gave you, to understand, to predict how the system behaves. And I mean, Kim and I were trying to decide what it is we wanted to predict, and it seems to me there's two different things we'd want to predict. One is the sort of system's behavior of this in terms of, for example, how frequently it goes lytic versus lysogenic, how stable the lysogenic state is, how much ultraviolet light you have to give to cause the switch from one state to the other. So it's hard to predict those things in a quantitative fashion. The other thing that's hard to predict is the effects of changes in the components. For example, what would happen if you weaken the binding of C1 twofold to all of its sites. Okay? And so those kinds of things, I think, are the sort of the kinds of issues that Kim's trying to get at in his computer modeling. Adam Arkin, whom you met a couple weeks ago, is doing or has done a lot of the same kind of thing, mostly to model this decision. But so let me ask you: what do you guys think about this kind of description as an adequate description of a gene regulatory circuit? Well, no, I'm sorry. What I've told you so far is sort of what it says in the textbooks. This is how it works. And it seems, and most people find that satisfactory. Right, okay, well, I'll tell you plenty of those in a minute. But Ned.
But I mean, the models do account for these two different sort of stable points, right?
So they, yes.
So it's more like the question of decision which basin you're going to go to, or switch in between that needs to work.
Well, it doesn't mean the models are right. I mean, they're consistent with it, and they certainly describe the properties of lambda as we find it in nature. Maybe when I go on, we'll see where I'm coming from. And so one, yeah. David, what do you think?
When you say documented, you mean beyond phage?
Yeah.
This kind?
Yeah.
Well, this is an unusual kind of switch, right? Because you're talking, it is phage dependent in the sense that you got lysis or
lysis. Yeah, but it doesn't have to be lytic.
But you could, you could imagine a situation where when it went to the lytic state, it was stable, and there are genetic ways of doing it,
yeah.
Like I said before you came. But well, there are people making things like the toggle switch that Jim Collins made.
But
yeah.
I'm
not sure. Can you think of an example?
So we heard a ghost story.
But this is methylation dependent. So the question is, can you have a metastable switch that doesn't depend upon yeast, for example, have switches like that? I don't know any in bacteria. It's so hard when you say like it. You know how far, like how much.
Well, yes.
Okay. So in your study, it depends on something physical changing of DNA, right? So here nothing is changing. It's just the concentration of protein that is changing.
And the answer is yes. Yeast
captain.
Saccharomyces doesn't have any, Cerevisiae doesn't have any DNA methylases, and they have metastable switches. How they exactly work isn't clear, but it looks like complexes on the DNA, two kinds of complexes can form, and those complexes tend to be self-perpetuating. They're self-perpetuating states. Involving chromatin structure, and no one really knows exactly how they work, but they exist. They do exist.
But in bacteria, there are several positive factors that you can follow from one to the other.
Well, you could even think of the lack operand as a switch. Because
No,
you really can't. No, you can't.
Lack operand is a passive thing. You give it a certain concentration, it doesn't.
No, it can be a little more complicated.
Oh, okay, well, I mean,
okay, let's talk
about the
let's talk about lambda. No,
we understand the lambda in the sense that we understand why it uses this kind of topology rather than something else that might have.
No, that's not what I'm after at all.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's it's a good question, but that's.
Strike you as interesting or accessible to say what you understand based on the physiology, why some other design would have worse properties.
Well, so I mean. Part of the answer to that goes back to what I was saying before, is we're not studying under this natural environment. And so we don't know much about how in the natural environment the various behaviors, especially for the lysis-lysogeny decision, we can't really predict unless we studied in that environment how that's going to be influenced. And
but perhaps one can maybe make an argument for switching employing a repressor in terms of the unit, right? So once you have a repressor in there, you're going to repress other guys, should they be any or any, or is something like this that can be argued?
Like I said, I'm not very good at making those arguments because I guess I find them hard to relate to the natural situation.
I don't really know how immunity works. How do immunity work?
Immunity. So what immunity means is if you have a cell that already has a lambda integrated and it's making C1 and C1's shutting everything else off in the way I said, then if another lambda comes into the cell, its genome comes in, it circularizes, and the C1 also works to shut off its lytic genes. And so this lambda can't grow, it just sits there. And
people still allow the other guys to integrate.
No, it shuts off integration as well.
Yeah, this can't integrate because some of the lytic genes, you need to express the lytic genes. Well, that's even more complicated because. Okay, so that's a good question. Let's go back to that for a minute. Remember I said in the lysogenic pathway, there are two things that have to happen. One is that C1 has to win, and that's involved the action of C2, however C2 works. The other is that the lambda has to integrate, physically the DNA has to integrate. As it turns out, and I didn't mention this, that also involves the action of C2. This is actually a very cool thing, so I'll tell you about it in a little bit of detail. Even though it'll keep us from answering the big question. Okay. So the attachment site lies at a particular place in the lambda DNA. And right next to it is this gene called INT that's required for the integration process. INT can be expressed from two different promoters. It can be expressed from the PL promoter that I talked about already. The physicists spend a lot of time on their knees like this. The other place it can be expressed is from, this is so complicated, I think if I talk about this it'll take 15 minutes. Let's forget about it.
Well, no.
Well, all right. It's expressed from a promoter called PI, I for INT. PI is stimulated by C2. In a cell that's infected with lambda, INT can be expressed either from the PL message or from the PI message. But INT that's expressed, this is the part that gets complicated. So the first thing that's expressed from PL is a protein called N. And N acts as an anti-terminator. I told you it was complicated. N modifies the properties of RNA polymerase in such a way that it's insensitive to signals that ordinarily stop the transcription, termination signals. It turns out there's a terminator over here, and this terminator, if this transcript is made from PI, it terminates here. But if it's made from PL, this transcript is modified by N, and it reads through that terminator. Okay? So now we've got two messages, one of which terminates at the terminator, and the other of which keeps going. Turns out that this message is unstable. The PL message is unstable because if it reads through this terminator, it folds up into a structure that causes it to be degraded. Whereas this message is stable. So if you make int from the PL message, you can't make int from the PL message because the message is degraded very quickly. I told you it was complicated. Whereas PI, the PI message is quite stable. Okay? So, for lambda, sorry, what?
Nothing can be made from PL.
Well, this message is degraded back a certain ways, and then there's another signal that stabilizes
it.
No, it just degrades it into the middle of int. Okay. Okay, so why am I telling you that? I'm not quite sure anymore. Okay, so what happens when it's going lysogenic? This is a regulatory decision. C1 can win without this happening. For example, if you have an int mutant, C1, the cell can still follow the make that regulatory decision. This is a physical DNA recombination event that requires that, well, it doesn't really require this regulatory decision to be made, but it accompanies it, because it only occurs when you make C2. You can't make int from this transcript because it's degraded. And we'll get to what happens in a minute. It raises another problem. Okay, so for integration, so what brought this on was you asked me when these decisions are made. They're kind of made concurrently. Okay? Right. And then, so for a stable lysogen to arise, both of these things have to happen. Okay. So you remember I said, this is the cool part, finally. So you remember I said that the PL message is unstable. So then, this is the part I didn't talk about yet. If you have a lambda prophage and it switches from the lysogenic state to the lytic state, the first thing that happens is you get a recombination event that reverses, so that's the integration, it requires int. You get a reversal of that. And to do that, you need int. You actually need a second protein called excise. Excise is located here. To make excise, you have to express them from the PL promoter. And in fact, there's no C2, so how do you make some int? This is the cool part. So in lambda, the terminator lies just to the left of the attachment site, but when it's in the chromosome, the terminator is over here, so now the PL transcript doesn't have that level of control. So it's a topologically different relationship. Now this message is stable. Okay, so now it can make an excise from there and cause this reaction to happen. Big digression. Okay. Okay, you're right, that's where that came. So if you have a cell that has it integrated, it's making C1, the new phage comes in, the C1 represses it, so there's no int around to cause it to integrate. It just comes in and it just sits there and gets diluted out eventually. If you put in 50 or 100 lambdas, it titrates all the C1 and then they can grow, but that's an unusual situation. Okay? So because it doesn't have its own replication gene. It has its own replication genes, but they're repressed. If you clone PBR322 into it, then yeah, it could replicate as a plasmid at that state. Okay. So it's not immune to other phages. Each phage has its own immunity specificity because that's determined by the DNA binding specificity of the repressor for its cognate sites. So if you have, let's say, another phage called 434, if 434 infects a lambda, it grows just as something that's lysogenic for lambda. It grows just as if the lambda wasn't there.
What about other phages that can be integrated?
Other phages can be integrated, yeah. Well, that's a little complicated. I'm not sure.
You can make double lysogens between 434 and lambda.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have two different sites that are different.
Well, some
it can even be the same site. If you make a lambda 434 with a lambda with 434 immunity protein, you can have a dilysogen.
So if you make something that's lambda but has the C1 and CRO of 434, yeah, you can get a layout where you'd have, let's say, the one with lambda immunity here and the 434 over here, or vice versa. These are not completely stable because this is like a tandem duplication. You can get recombination that would excise one or the other of them. Yeah. I'm not sure. Completely. Yeah. But there's other phages that have different attachment sites. There's, 10 or 15 or 20 known in general. I don't know. Don't know that anybody's done that. So just to sort of amplify why it might matter, if this is the E. coli chromosome, and it's initiating replication here. Things that are close to the, if these are replication forks moving out and duplicating the DNA, then things that are close to the original have a higher gene dosage than ones that are further away. Lambda's about somewhere like that. Most of them tend to be down in, well, I don't actually know where they all are. Most of the ones I know about are down around in here, but there could be, there's probably lots of different places, and I don't know the answer to that. I was hoping to get to that. Okay, so let's ask that question in, now what I'm going to talk about is stuff that we've done, and it's going to seem pretty specific by comparison because it's just one lab doing some experiments. So let's ask a few questions. So one way of asking this question, do I need to convince people that lambda is a good model system for studying? Okay, good. Okay. So one general kind of question that we've addressed is, which of all the features I've talked about are essential for the virus circuitry to work right? So one way to say that, it's the one way to think about that is to say, okay, everything has to be just the way it is or it won't work at all. That seems a little implausible, but lambda is the way we find it in nature. And to the limited extent it's been done, other similar phages have these same features. They have the C1 stimulating its own expression. They have cooperative DNA binding. They have differing affinities of C1 and CRO for the operators, and so forth. This hasn't been investigated in a lot of detail. But the question is, are those features necessary for lambda to work properly, for the lambda circuitry to work right? Something like that. So one way to think about it is there a basic ground plan? And a lot of these features I've told you about, are they bells and whistles? Or are they all essential for it to work right? Okay? So we've done experiments on three different aspects of it, and our experiments lead to the same conclusion in each of these cases, namely that individually at least, these features are refinements and they're not essential to the behavior of lambda.
But minimal set of whatever it's like you have to talk about a context, right?
Okay, so let's say what my criteria are for what I mean when I say it works right. I don't mean to imply that if I boiled it down to some, let's just imagine I could keep stripping away all these bells and whistles and get, you know, just the bare minimum. I wouldn't want to imply that that bare minimum is just as good as the wild type. Obviously, the wild type has features that contribute to its fitness because that's the way we find it. And other viruses that have been studied, as I say, to a limited extent, have those same features where they've been looked for. I'm not trying to talk about evolution here. I'm just talking about what's the minimum it takes to make this regulatory circuitry work right. If you look in the textbooks, it always says, I mean, I don't know, a lot of textbooks are taking all this stuff out, actually. But the ones that talk about these features as if they're really important for it to work right. And, you know, I've taught it that way myself for a long time to graduate students, but that doesn't mean that it's right. And just to say why, part of why it's possible to start challenging this, if I put it in that kind of combative way, start questioning these things is we have tools now that we didn't have 20 years ago when all these ideas were laid down and the basic circuitry was worked out, mostly by Mark Potashny at Harvard. So we have things like PCR, recombinant, a lot more sophisticated recombinant DNA, site-directed mutagenesis, really easy, cheap sequencing, etc. So the tools are just a lot more advanced. Okay, so what are the criteria for saying that the virus, that the circuitry is working right? I think that's important to define and answer to your question. One is it needs to have lytic growth. That seems like a bare minimum. And we define that as making a plaque, preferably a nice, large, juicy plaque that looks like wild type, but some of the things we worked with don't have that property, so I'm not going to be too fussy about that. The next one is it can pursue in the lysogenic state. It can form stable lysogens, and those lysogens are stable. And the third is that it can switch from the lysogenic state, to the lytic state after the SOS system is turned on by something like UV irradiation. And so just as a working definition of how this circuitry is working right, it can have the two stable regulatory states, it can do lytic growth, and it can switch from the one to the next. Ideally, the pattern of this, which I haven't talked about yet, will resemble the wild type, but that's kind of a refinement. Let me just say what I mean by that so I'm not trying to be mysterious. If, and Kim and his coworkers don't find this kind of behavior like we do, and I'm not sure we have to figure out why that is, but if we look at the percent of cells switching, as a function of the amount of DNA damage, which we control by how much UV light we give them, we see a kind of a threshold behavior. And we're not actually measuring percentage of cell switching, we're just measuring the number of phages that come out. But there's a kind of a threshold below which not much happens, then rather abruptly, the switching becomes efficient. So ideally for point three, if we want to have circuitry be normal, we'd like to reproduce this pattern. There's two features of this pattern that we'd like to reproduce. One is the shape of the curve, and the other is the set point for the threshold. But it might be hard to set the set point exactly right. So at a minimum, we'd like it to be able to switch. Ideally, we'd like to have behavior similar to this. And I probably won't get to what we've done along those lines. In fact, definitely I won't. Okay. Well, it's hard to say, but it's close to 100% switching. Yeah, about 100, just almost 100% switch, yeah, if you give a high enough dose. I mean, it's complicated because the cells start getting killed at the high doses, and so it's a little difficult to be sure.
Why is it just, quote, this drug? Because if you imagine very large doses of UV radiation, it can damage.
space itself, right?
Right. So I'm sorry, what's the question?
A very high dosage of
kilohertz. Yeah, if you give it a dose that's 10 times higher than that threshold, everything starts to get killed, and so a lot of the cells don't give anything. So it's kind of, we try not to work at those high doses. Okay, so let's talk about, so these are the criteria for whether a feature is essential. So the idea is if we can get rid of a particular feature of the lambda circuitry and still get a phage that has these properties, then we could argue that at least in an otherwise, a context that's otherwise close to wild type, that feature is not essential. Okay, so let me just illustrate that by talking about, well, I'll just talk about all three examples and I'll be brief about it so Kim will have some time. The first thing that we've tried to get rid of is the cooperative DNA binding. So remember, C1, and I'll just draw it as a dimer, as a little blob, that's a dimer, another dimer, makes cooperative interactions between two adjacent binding sites. There's another feature I haven't talked about that on this scale will be out in the next room somewhere. There's another site, the OL region, where we talked about that promoter, and that's thought to be able to loop and make contacts with this. I don't want to talk about that unless somebody asks and insists. But presumably, the mutants that we use to interact to destroy cooperativity would also destroy that looping property as well. So that's what I'll talk about now. So if we want to ask if cooperative DNA binding is essential, the approach is to get a mutant in C1 that can't do cooperative binding, okay? And then ask, can we put that mutant into the virus and see what happens? And so there's a number of mutants that have been isolated that affect cooperative binding, but there are not very many that are appropriate for this study. Most of them have been characterized only by genetic means, and so we can't be confident that they're completely destroyed for cooperativity. There's only three that have been also characterized biochemically and shown biochemically to knock this out. And as luck would have it, only one of those is useful for our studies because the other two interfere with the cleavage reaction that inactivates LexA. If you can't have cleavage, you can't get the switching. So the one mutation that we've worked with is a mutation, two different mutations that affect a tyrosine residue, residue 210 in their protein. Does everybody know this nomenclature? Probably not. So this nomenclature, there's a 20-letter code for all the amino acids. Y stands for tyrosine. This means that tyrosine 210 has been changed to an asparagine. The other one we work with is Y210H. These are in C1, yeah. So this one's been characterized biochemically a lot. This one we're in the process of characterizing it biochemically now. If we make a lambda, so let's just talk about how this kind of project goes. So we want to test if cooperative DNA binding is essential. So we make a lambda that has a C1 mutation that destroys cooperative binding. Okay, and what we find not so unexpectedly, we've weakened, in a sense, you can think about it qualitatively again, that you've sort of weakened or enfeebled C1 from doing what it ordinarily is able to do. And so this phage, it turns out, can't follow the lysogenic state. So you might say, well, obviously cooperativity is essential. But as a geneticist, my immediate reaction to that is to say, okay, can we get compensating mutations that'll restore the ability to lysogenize? And so we got mutations that have that plus some other kind of mutation. Everybody remember what these kinds of mutations are called? This is called a suppressor analysis. So this mutation destroys the normal phenotype, it changes the phenotype. We try to get mutations that restore it back to something that's the normal phenotype or close to it.
Mechanistically, the mutation destroys property binding by indicating sharing with the site with two persons.
That's right. Yeah. It's in the structure. It's at the, it's thought to be at an interface between two dimers.
Could you also describe cooperative binding by inserting space in DNA between those sites to make each other fit?
Could do, but then it messes up the promoters too. I mean, if we start going into the OR region and mucking around, I'll give you an example of that in a bit, if I have time. And but it's hard to make one change and it only affects one thing because the promoters get messed up as well. Yeah, you could do that, but you'd have to make other changes too, and then it would get even. Example of how we could, you know, pursue this to reach another goal, maybe mentioned briefly. Yeah.
Just to, if Michael Sawatu was here, he would have said, well, you destroy the cooperative interaction, but maybe the two-check essential nature of cooperative is to actually compensate for making an O2 a stronger binder.
Okay.
Okay, so that the occupation of O2 is the same, but there's no cooperative.
That might be what he would say, yeah. So we get, well, I mean,
then you say it's essential.
Okay, let's see what we get when we isolate suppressors. I don't remember all the things we got. I'll just tell you the one that worked, just to make a long story short.
I just want to get a clarification. If you don't know the structure of a lambda, how do you know this mutation?
By genetic tests, yeah. Both of these do. This one can barely lysogenize. It seems to be somewhat different from this one's been characterized biochemically. Sorry.
So what you know, it doesn't lysogenize. So how do you know it's because it's changing?
We don't know that. But this one, like I said, this one's been characterized a lot more extensively biochemically. And it's been shown, I don't know if anybody checked that the cleavage was normal. Its dimerization is normal. So every function that we know about for this protein is normal except for the cooperative DNA binding. It binds normally to an individual site. It's just it's binding to adjacent sites. OR1 plus OR2 is weakened.
So you don't get a sigmoidal binding
to it? Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Well, we're doing that now for this one. This was done years ago by somebody else. But now we have this on a fate. So now what I'm telling you about is what's going on in the cell. Yeah, you're right. I mean, mechanistically, we can't be certain that that's the only problem. Well, we're getting it now. I don't know if we have it yet or not. I think it's, you know, it's happening right now. Okay? So like I said, if we try to start with this and get suppressors, operationally what we do is we take this, it can't lysogenize, so we isolate variants of it that can lysogenize, and we have powerful genetic methods that let us select for rare variants of this. So the idea is if we start... Okay. This is how molecular biologists think. So this phage has on it a marker for a gene for kanamycin resistance. So if we infect cells with normal lambda that carries this, lysogens can be easily selected as ones that make the cells resistant to kanamycin. Okay. So if we have tendinite cells and we infect one of them with a lambda that carries this marker, that's the only one that'll grow on our plates with kanamycin. Okay, so that's called a selection because only the thing you want can grow. Okay, now we start with two, let's say 10 to the ninth of these. Whenever we make a stock of virus, new mutants are always arising at some low frequency. So we can't have 10 to the ninth of these that are all the same. The stock's always going to contain some small number of mutants. And so the idea is maybe some of those mutants will do something to this to restore its ability to make a lysogen. So if we take a stock of this and infect cells with it and then just do a selection for kanamycin, we get out ones that have second site mutants. Well, we also, in principle, could get out a revertant of this that would change the asparagine back to tyrosine, but that's kind of rare. Okay? So that's the approach, is to say, okay, I'm going to try to, I mean, it's like Mike Sabajo's approach in a lot of ways. Yeah, I agree. Is to say, okay, are there other ways of compensating for it that would restore that behavior in the absence of cooperativity? And so what do we get as suppressors? We get a lot of things that we don't understand very well. So one of the virtues of lambda is if you get a mutant, you have at least a fighting chance of understanding it mechanistically. The one that we got that behaves the best is one that has the mutant you mentioned. It has a mutation in OR2, we call OR2 up, because we think it strengthens the binding of C1 to OR2. It also has a PRM mutation. PRM is a promoter that makes C1, that makes PRM modestly stronger. So now we can make more C1, and that C1 can bind pretty well to OR2. And you remember, if it binds to OR2, it can stimulate its own expression from PRM. So these two mutations together compensate for the defect of the cooperativity and allow this phage to grow normally.
Do you find them or, them?
Sorry?
Do you find all these changes by sequencing all the ones that are selected?
Yeah. So we get a lot of variants, and then we just sequence them all, and then we character, and so you get a lot of the same thing usually when you do that. So you take ones that are different and characterize them in more detail. No. We're sequencing regions that we think are that are likely to be involved in the regulation. And it's certainly possible to miss things. But if we see the same mutation or the same kinds of mutations coming up over and over again in independent selections, we can be pretty certain. And there's always ways of taking a virus and taking the mutation that you think is important and putting it back into an otherwise wild-type virus to see if the behavior tracks with that. That's the hardcore way to do it. It's called a back cross.
You also check that the cooperativity is not restored somehow. They sequence the part, which is.
Oh, we sequence.
This mutation wasn't reversed.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, we sequence the C1 gene to make sure it still has just this mutation in it. Yeah.
Traditional model we did with the lambda said OR2 up isn't as stable as the original one in the lysogenic state. Is that.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, the thing is that it could seem like OR2 up wouldn't often, at least in very, very simple models, wouldn't even be a stable lysogen.
You mean it wouldn't be able to go lytically stably, or?
If you write down the traditional system biology model and if you have no cooperativity, okay, I think it's even hard to stabilize the lysogenic state. So that may be an interesting question.
Okay, so we're also providing more C1. And there's an additional factor, that looping I was talking about,
right,
can't occur in this case, and so you don't get negative autoregulation of PRM in addition. Sorry? Okay, so this is the OR region I was talking about all earlier. Over here, about 2.5 kilobases away, is another region called OL where C1 also binds to three sites. And if C1's bound here and here, the wild type can loop, can make interactions between C1 bound here and here, presumably by cooperative interactions that involve the same residue. That hasn't been determined. So that has a negative autoregulatory effect on PRM. On PRM. Well,
PRM. And if you deletion of the different sites, will you reduce the depression by how much?
Well, that can't be done because there's functions over here that would kill the cell. But if you make a mutation here or a mutation here that at least weakens the looping, then it de-represses threefold, fivefold. It depends on who's doing it exactly. But it's a substantial effect.
That actually again argues very strongly in favor of the looping being the main cause of the depression.
Well, I don't want to try to make a detailed mechanistic argument about this. All I want to argue from this is that the behavior of this phage with these three mutations, these two mutations compensate for the defect of that. So here's a version of the circuitry that's certainly not normal. It probably can't compete well with the wild type, but it's missing the cooperative DNA binding, presuming that when we characterize this mutant protein, it's actually defective for cooperativity. It certainly doesn't have very much, but we can't really say yet that it has none. Okay.
What is the phenotype of OR2 deletion? Can I just remove that site or?
If you mutate it so C1 can't bind to it, then you can't go lysogenic. You might be able to compensate for that by having an up promoter. I'm not sure. Well, there's
O1 will not be able to activate.
So let's redraw the promoters. And so PRM is here, PR is here, site 3, 2, and 1. So C1 does two things. It binds here. That's the normal thing, is binding cooperatively to these two sites. That shuts off PR, and it activates PRM. If you prevent the binding here, the observation is it can't lysogenize. And the presumption is.
But suppose that you remove site 2 and move site 1 closer to PRM promoter so that dimer can help.
Well, I'm not sure whether you can do that because, like I said, these promoters are right on top of these sites, and you'd have to study the sequences to see whether you could make an arrangement of the type you're talking about that would leave the promoters more or less. I mean, it's hard to change one thing in here without changing lots of things. I mean, drastic changes of the type you're talking about, especially. So
I guess the question is, so suppose you remove type 2 and make these various length linkers between three months. So the question is, would any one of them?
I don't know. I don't think anybody's done that. But it, like I said, it would be complicated. I mean, that's a situation where you'd want to make a random library and shove a bunch of stuff in there and see if it works.
Maybe you said this, but what happens if you take the suppressor and go back to the original C1?
We haven't done that, but my guess is that C1 would always win, and it would be hard for it to grow lytically. I'm not sure that's right, but it might be that. I don't remember. It's a good experiment. So the question is whether the suppressors would push things so far in the other direction that the lytic state wouldn't be able to go. And I don't know the answer for those.
So all along you've been describing what happens to the OR region, and the OL, is it symmetrical or is it not important for this decision?
Well, OL is probably not important for the initial decision of which way to go, though I don't know that anybody's actually tested that. You can't knock OL out completely because there are genes over here that need to be repressed. I mean, one could probably figure out a way to do that somehow. But I don't know that anybody has done that. There's three sites at OL, site 1, 2, and 3. These two sites, C1 binds cooperatively like that. This site had no function ascribed to it. We found a function for it that I won't have time to get to, I guess. Okay, let me just mention two other things and then I'll let Kim talk. Do people want to stay after 11 o'clock? Because we can keep talking for a long time, but.
We should do a little break and.
Right now?
Well,
let me say my. Okay, this is a logical place now, but I can just mention briefly two other things that we've done that, again, show that certain features aren't essential. Then I'll talk about evolution a little bit, even though I said that's not a good thing to do. And then we can take a break and Kim can talk. How's that sound? I mean, I've got more things I could talk about too. So the other thing that we've been able to get rid of is the C1 auto-activation of its own expression. Maybe oftentimes people call that positive control. So you remember that when C1's bound to OR2, it stimulates its own expression. There are mutations in C1 that have been shown to prevent that from happening. And so what we did was something quite similar to what I described already, which is to cross those mutations onto lambda. So we make a lambda that again has a C1 mutation. In this case, it's in a different residue, D38, changed to N. This we find, so this mutation, this protein's been characterized in vitro and it interferes with the positive control.
Does that mutation interfere with contact with the alpha subunit?
Sigma 70.
Sigma 70.
And there's a paper, I don't know if it's published yet, by Anne Hochschild, that where she's collaborated with Seth Darst to make a model at least for exactly what these contacts are. It's kind of cool. Okay, so we make this, it can barely lysogen, I mean, it can make lysogens. But if we do these lysogens, the stability of these lysogens is pretty limited. If we do the same UV dose response that I talked about before, where the wild type would be, just to exaggerate a little bit, something like that, these would be like that. I mean, you just have to sort of wave them under the UV light and they induce. So they barely have enough C1 function to hang in there. And so we wanted to get mutants that push them over toward this, and we did an enrichment scheme that I could describe if we want to belabor this later. But basically we can just, let's just say that we can start with these and apply an enrichment scheme to get variants that scoot this curve over somewhere close to wild type. And you could imagine in principle how we could do that. Let's just say that we have those. To do these properly, what we did was apply this enrichment scheme to something where we did a procedure I haven't talked about yet. And this is, different people call it different things. I'll call it doping. And in this case, what we're doping is the PRM promoter. So what we're trying to do is to get variants of PRM. We're looking for suppressors again, like I said before, but we're trying to get variants of PRM that restore the normal growth property. And I don't want to talk about the gory details of the cloning. Let's just say that what we're able to do in a series of steps is to take PRM, and I want to draw this in more detail now. I'm turning it backwards from the normal way, and there, the minus, so remember promoters have two consensus positions, minus 35 and minus 10. It happens that the first two nucleotides in each case overlap with the operator. So this is OR3, this is OR2. And we don't want to mess with those sites because we're concerned that if we do, we'll interfere with the repressor binding to repressor and or crow binding to these operator sites. So we just want to change the promoter. And so we target four residues in each of the minus 35 and the minus 10, the ones that lie outside the operators. The logic of this clear? Mm-hmm. So we don't want to target these. So if we target these, what that means is, I'll say what the X means now, it means that we make a pool where each of those positions is randomized. So it could be either A, G, C, or T. So there's 65,000 and change possible ways, 4 to the 8th, that we could make 65,000 different combinations of these that would make PRM, including the wild type. We make a pool of those, and by means I don't want to talk about, I mean, I can if you want, but it's not important for what we're talking about here. We can cross those onto the phage, then we get a pool of phages that have all these different promoters, and we can select by various stages ones that shift this UV induction curve over so it's similar to wild type. Okay? And just to make a long story short, we're able to do that pretty readily with this particular mutant protein. And we can get lots of variants of PRM that are stronger, and so they've compensated for the loss of the positive, well, we presume they're stronger. I don't think those have been checked in a lot of detail yet, but that's the presumption. So we've compensated for the loss of autoregulation by changing the promoter in some compensatory way. So one thing we want to, I mean, it's interesting to think about this from a systems circuitry kind of view that why is there positive control? Presumably the positive control has the effect that at low, at moderate levels of C1, you get sort of a positive amplification of that signal. And the way Kim explains it to me, you're pushing it away from a separatrix that divides system going lytic from a system going lysogenic. So it's pushing it away from a sort of a point of uncertainty. If we get rid of that positive control, it seems like that feature is missing. So as the levels of C1 drop, let's say if BRCA is cleaving it, you might get the system to respond in a less decisive way. It might switch in a less decisive way. I don't know. We haven't explored that yet.
I mean, the signal to noise would be affected, essentially. In other words, it would be a little wishy-washy about the setting, which way to go, because you don't have, it's not poised at a, whatever, or engineers call it, a critical point on where it can decide which way to go.
Something like that.
Because I would think that these mutants that you have would have a harder, if you looked at their ability to undergo the lysis pathway, would be screwed up in that.
Well, we have to look at that, yeah. We haven't yet.
PRM is going to be such strong binding. assuming affinity is way up.
Well, it we don't know yet. I mean, they're probably not super strong PRM. If we have a super strong PRM, then they have trouble going lytic. That's right. But we don't. These aren't like that. I don't think. That hasn't been checked carefully yet. So just to go back to the point I was making a minute ago, engineers talk about the importance of positive control or positive feedback for making switches decisive. Here, individually, we've gotten rid of two different features that are both contributing to positive feedback. The cooperativity by making the binding curve of C1 sigmoid, the auto activation by giving positive feedback to C1 levels, C1 expression. We haven't tried getting rid of both of these, and I'd be curious whether people think that effort would be worthwhile. I don't know if it would be or not. We can't get rid of all the features of positive feedback. And I'd appreciate feedback from people again about, I mean, was it you that was saying? I can't remember. Somebody was saying that.
From us.
Oh, sure. Now we got to get rid of that. Okay, so let me just say there are other examples, other features that cause positive feedback that we can't really get rid of for reasons that may seem trivial, but they're important. The other is C1 dimerizes rather weakly. So these are things that we've actually shown are not, at least by themselves, essential by the criteria that I've described. C1 dimerizes rather weakly. So in the cell at low C1 concentrations, a lot of it's in the form of monomers. You could say, well, make it a tight dimerization so you don't have that kind of positive feedback. The problem with doing that is, just as a practical matter, that only monomers of C1 are cleaved in the RecA-dependent cleavage reaction. So we can't really make a strong dimerization. And we can't get rid of it because it doesn't bind as a monomer. So this is not something we can get rid of. Somebody, and I don't remember who it was anymore, it was one of you guys, was telling me that I can also think of C1 inhibiting Crow expression as positive feedback too. And I don't know that I can get rid of that unless we start working with Crow mutants, which are lethal, so. Yeah.
C1 dimerization is also regarded as a source of cooperativity.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
But that is it possible to make a C1 dimer out of just one piece of the DNA?
one piece of one protein, an intramolecular dimer. Nobody's done it for C1. Somebody's done it for CRO, and I don't remember what the properties of those are.
That will get rid of that residual cleavage.
You're right. But I don't know what it would do to the cleavage. Huh. I mean, so
well,
in other words...
At least you can see whether...
Well, let me put it a different way. I can't really apply all of my criteria for normal regulatory circuitry if I get rid of cleavage. I could still ask it to be stable in the two regulatory states, but it wouldn't be able to do the switching if I got rid of that, unless I created some new mechanism. Did you have a question? So, okay. I have actually a couple more things to say, but it's, I'll say them after the break, and then you'll get your turn finally. Okay, good. I'm gonna bring a coffee cup. So I want to try to wrap this up because I want to leave some time for Kim, but I do want to talk about a couple of other issues. The first... Well, that's Boris's seat. Okay. Okay. So the last thing that we've changed so one way of describing the first hour and a half of what I was talking about is I was giving you a sort of just-so story. It sounds great, it sounds plausible, it sounds like it ought to work fine, but for the most part, a lot of the features that people have talked about haven't been tested in the way that I'm talking about doing now. The last feature I'm going to talk about goes back to the description I gave you of how C1 continues to win once it's won, how CRO wins once it continues to win. And you remember that I said for CRO, CRO binds tightly to site 3 and weakly to sites 2 and 1, so that if you have some CRO and no C1, it shuts off PRM. And doesn't affect its own expression. There is not negative autoregulation. As CRO levels build up, it starts binding to these sites and damping down its own expression, but that's not an essential part of what I'm talking about. If, on the other hand, you have, okay, let's, it's so fussy. Okay. If you have C1, on the other hand, it binds cooperatively like this, shutting off PRM and stimulating its own expression. And the reason it binds to these sites and not to this site is this is a tight binding site, strong, this is weak, this is weak. For CRO, this is strong, this is weak, this is weak. Okay, again, that's what the textbooks say. That it's critical to have these differential affinities of these proteins for these three sites for the switch to work right. So we thought as a test of that, what we would do, and this is actually published, the only paper we've published on all this stuff so far, and I can give you the reference. It's an IMBO journal 4 years ago. And we thought what we would do is to change, is to get rid of this differential affinities. And to see if the circuitry still worked. And so I'll be really brief about this since it's published, and I'll mention one other thing briefly and then turn it over to Kim. So what we did was to change the flanking, all the differential affinities have to do with the affinities for OR3 and OR1, the two flanking sites. And so we changed those sites so that at the position of 3, or 1, the two sites were the same. So we made a phage that had OR1 sequence in both positions. We made another phage that had OR3 at both positions. We made a third phage that had kind of a hybrid site that was closer to OR3 than to OR1. We made these by site-directed mutagenesis on plasmids, crossed them onto the phage, and then characterized their behavior. And they're surprisingly normal, actually. They're not completely normal, and I don't want to imply that they're as fit as wild type, but I'll tell you what we know about them a little bit. They all grow pretty well. This one has a lytic growth defect. It's a bit poor, It goes okay, but it's just not as good as wild type, and it can evolve toward wild type in a way I'll say briefly. These grow fine. This is like wild type as well. They all can make stable lysogens. They can all switch from the lysogenic state to the lytic state if you UV the cells. They're quant.
The first one.
Sorry?
When you say the first one is lytic, that's all is lytic.
No, I'm sorry. Back to my criteria for lytic growth. For normal circuitry. One is that it has to be able to grow lytically.
Right.
They all can grow lytically, and that's not too surprising. They all can make stable lysogens, and they can all switch from the lysogenic state to the lytic state. However, there's quantitative differences in these curves. If we have the one, so I call this one 3-2-3, 1-2-1. 3-2-3 switches very easily. 1-2-1 switches in sort of an intermediate UV dose range. And the 3'-2'3' is weird in a way that I don't understand, is it switches, but it doesn't grow very well. And I don't understand this, but there may be some problem, and this is just a speculation, so something to work on in the future. There may be a problem of this communicating with the OL regions through this looping thing I was talking about. It may be that the looping is messed up somehow in this phage. And that makes a timing problem, perhaps, when it's trying to switch from the lysogenic state to the lytic state. But that's total speculation. I don't know the answer. I don't know the reason. So all of these are defective in some way. This one is really pretty normal, except it's just a bit easier to induce. So again, the argument here is that these differential affinities are a refinement to a basic ground plan. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit in terms of evolution. If you have a system that's as complicated, and this is a simple system, lambda, relatively simple. If you have a system even with this level of complexity, how does it arise in the course of evolution? Pretty hard question to answer with any kind of assurance. To use a buzzword, we published this stuff, and the title of the paper is Robustness of a Regulatory Circuit. And we use the word robustness, and I mean, we try to define it. I understand that everybody has their own definition for it. In our case, we defined it basically as saying it's resistant to changes in the parameters, that the behavior may not be normal, but it's relatively, kind of normal. It's certainly not a very quantitative description. And Mike Savageau's treatment doesn't handle these kinds of situations. We were talking about that a little bit before. I think the idea, though, is if you have various, if you can change various parameters of the system, like the affinity, so these mutations change the affinities of both C1 and CRO for these sites. So we're changing two parameters at the same time. And yet we get a system that works, pretty well. We have one example, which I'll describe in a minute, but let me give you the model, and it'll illustrate that model. The idea is if you have a basic circuit design that'll work kind of, it's easier if it can assume a lot of different forms, if the system's robust, then if it can work in a lot of different ways with quantitatively different parameters, it's a lot easier to find it in the course of evolution than if everything has to be just so, if all the bells and whistles have to be in place. And so the robustness makes that space, the parameter space, I guess you guys would call it, a lot bigger than if everything had to be, pretty close to the wild type. And so we have an example of that's described in the paper, so I don't want to belabor it, but remember I said this one grows poorly. So it grows poorly. What that means operationally is when, if we plate it out on plates, if the wild type makes a plaque that, to exaggerate somewhat, is nice and large, this might make a little small plaque. So if it grows poorly, then if it can mutate to something that makes a larger, that grows better, there'll be a big selective advantage to that mutating to something that grows better. And so all we have to do operationally is make stocks of this and then plate them out, and we can get large plaque variants. I mean, technically, it's quite simple. These are ones that grow better, so if we make a stock of this and we get a mutant that arises that can grow better, it's going to outgrow the thing it's competing with. So we can isolate these, and one of them has this site mutating to this site I called 3 prime. It's maybe important to realize that OR1 and OR3 differ by only 3 positions. And so I'll just indicate this is the OR3 that's at the position of OR1. Now we can mutate this to something that has the identity of OR1 here. I think this is a C and that's a T, but I don't remember. I mean, that's the other way around. This is a T and that's a C. It doesn't really matter for our purposes. This thing has mutated under selective pressure for better lytic growth, to something that's closer to wild type. Is that clear what I'm getting at? So, I mean, it just sort of lends a little bit of plausibility to the idea that if you find a circuit that kind of works, then you can refine it in later stages. And like I said, all the lambdoid phages that have been isolated from nature that have been characterized to any significant extent have features that are at least broadly similar to these in lambda. So probably they're adaptive. I mean, it's a reasonable thing. These kinds of selective pressures, you'd think, would be, you know, pretty reasonable. It's reasonable to expect that they would occur in nature, even in different environments. Okay, so I'm almost ready to turn it over to Kim. Let me just say one more thing, and I'll just mention this as... Okay, this will be really brief. I'll just say what the study is here. So remember I said that the lambda, if we do a UV dose response curve, we get a curve like that. Kim and his buddies don't get that, but we do. And so, all we can do is our experiments. So we started with something that's 3-2-3, the same one I was talking about, and got variants of that that shift this curve over toward the wild type. And it's possible to get a large number of variants that shift the set point of this over to a lot of different positions. And I'll just say why we're doing that briefly. One reason is to ask the question is this set point optimized? That's a hard question to answer, of course, in the course of evolution. But we wanted to get the idea to get the idea that it's at least it's a plausible idea, because it's certainly easy to get mutations that alter the set point. Another thing is it might help us identify in principle features that contribute to putting the set point where it is. It doesn't really address the question of why it's steep. But one of the things that some of the mutants that came out of this are ones that disrupt that looping I was talking about before. All the mutants we get are at least compatible, or almost all of them are compatible with the idea that they're making more C1, and so it's harder to induce. You have to have the REC-A activated for a longer time to get the curve to be scooted over here. So if you have more C1, it takes longer to cleave, because if in a normal cell, and this is time now, if you follow the levels of C1 and give them a lot of UV, it takes about, I don't know if it's a straight line, it hasn't been measured that carefully, it takes about 30 minutes for all the C1 to be cleaved. And so if you have some low dose of UV where not all the C1's cleaved and the REC-A is no longer active, then the cell can recover, and that's what we think is happening. That's where this threshold comes from. It's really hard to talk about this briefly. The last thing, and I think I'll let Kim talk about this instead, but I'll just say what it is, and maybe it'll sort of lead into it. Should I talk about the stability really quickly? Or you want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I just continue now with what we Okay. So I will take over and talk a bit about what's wrong with the lambda. And so we raise this here and do it in the black bar. And basically, so we have got
an overview of the lambda, that it had an entry, there's some maintenance, and there's some exit. And the features of all of this are not understood. In the entry, maybe the thing that's most simple, in the entry we had to fight between PR and PIE. So that's basically what one should start modeling if one wanted to model that. Remember again, we had this DNA of the lambda, where we had some operator right here. We have a PRE this way, PR this way, and a PRE this way. And then we have PI in this way, PRF. So this is a good guy, this is a bad guy, this is a good guy. And this one and this one fight for control in the entry. And this one is producing some garbage here, and then it produces some C1. And if it succeeds in producing enough C1, C1 will shut down Crow, and then we have lysogeny. And the study of that. Oh, that's the entry. That's the entry. If it succeeds. If it doesn't succeed, the crow wins. And then. Then there will be a crow again. There will be a new fight in a new cell. There's no memory from cell to cell. Actually, we tried to test that, and there's no memory. That is a curious little experiment. Maybe there was a way of carrying memory in the phage by carrying a crow. And we could not see any signal of that. So that would have been a nice feature. Okay, so PR, PRE, and the experiment has essentially not been done any quantitative experiment except for Kaiser's old experiment, where he had this overshoot that John Little talked about, which is some kind of C1 is going to a high value before it goes down to a low value. Overshoot was quite substantially, and essentially nobody has really modeled. This is the fight.
It goes from zero and it goes to high value and then decays to some constant.
It decays to some constant for the successful lysogeny. And I don't remember this fraction here was quite substantial.
Your picture looks like it returns to zero.
Sorry. What? This is time. And this is C1. I think Arkin modeled it but didn't relate to this data. So he didn't have any overshoot basically. I don't know him what body. But okay, so that's one thing.
And T equals 0 is
infection. Yes, T equals 0 is maintenance. That's what I will talk about here. So I come to that. That's basically the fight between PR and PRM. PRM. This two. Oh, I don't really know where that probably happened somehow. I don't know, 20 minutes in or 10. I'm not sure.
30
minutes or 50.
But you know, that long other care, that's maintenance
stage. That's maintenance stage. That's very slow. Sorry, that would be very slow because that's by dilution. You don't have active degradation of C1. That's by dilution. That would be very slow. It would be locked here. I'm not really going to talk about this. This is one of the things that's not really studied in the lambda phase quantitatively, and if one wants standards here, once you model it and measure it, and it would be nice and possible with present day DLP to do it.
It's
a huge
model,
it does not relate to that at all.
Wait, it doesn't reproduce. But it's supposed to.
It's supposed to
reproduce. To describe all the machinery. So something, all the machinery, but it doesn't include the looping, for example. I'm afraid to see where the looping is.
The looping shouldn't.
Really does anybody happen. Know what the time scale of the formation really takes with protein structure?
No, just. Giving a short brief of what is lagging somewhere in the three basic states, and then we'll concentrate on this. So PR, PRM, maintenance, and there our lack of understanding was best revealed by the experiments that John just was going to tell you about, and I will tell you about a little bit later, that it actually doesn't matter so much whether you have symmetry around this operator 2 or not no symmetry around it. And that's kind of miraculous when you try to put in the numbers. You cannot really get it to work. And that I will come to. So that's PR, PRM5. And the exit, I think the problem is that actually if you have an exit, then you would have, imagine that you're starting to switching over to the crow state, or you are inducing. Then you produce a lot from this PR. You are then also making some C2, and the C2 goes back and try to reestablish lysogeny. How is that actually not going to do that? Why is it not happening? And it's apparently not, and there's some speculations that there's a little RNA piece that's released, OOP, but it's kind of, I think, fairly weakly substantiated, that binds to the C2 and somehow prevents it from being transcribed. But it's this is not understood, basically, I would say. That's, yeah?
Do I understand correctly that even though the switch in some sense is more or less symmetric flip-flop,
It's not for the C2. For the crow, it's very asymmetric, and for C1, it's very asymmetric.
But the point is that the life cycle is actually very, very asymmetric because to switch to a lysogeny state, you're not really switching from the lytic state.
No.
Right? Not at all. So
you're switching from, you are switching from, you're coming from somewhere else. There has been one study of switching from the lytic to the lysogeny state. In an amputated phase, in some amputated phase which could not go, because normally when you are in a lytic state, you're killing everything, so you have to maintain it. So you destroy. You're just studying. You study the region around.
But there is no way of reversing the lytic pathway. You can also start on it and whack it with.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So I mean, people talk about.
Basically, and then you can study how long time it takes for something in at this funny state of a lot of pro and no C1, how often does that switch back to the C1 state? And but that happened once every 100 thousand orders. There's been some measurement on that. So that's
it does not occur under any natural condition. When the cell goes, the host goes stationary, the phase doesn't reverse to lysogeny or.
In the DNA, they sit in the DNA nicely.
So that's how they're amputated. The replication genes are knocked out in this anti-termination protein.
So they're not really, they're lysogens, it's just that they're maintained by CRO.
Yeah.
They're lysogens.
Yeah, that's immune lysogens or something
like that.
They're physically in the chromosome, but their regulatory state has changed to anti-immune state. So pretty human frequency or something. They're N minus O.
Okay, so, and then of course the lytic state is maintained by having some CRO around that keeps C1 from reestablishing. And and the effort here is weaker than the effort for C1 to binding over there, because CRO only has to bind one place and C1 bind CRO for two places. So there's some kind of AND function here that makes the lysogenic state much more stable than the lytic state.
similar number for spontaneous?
Yeah, there's a number more than that. That's around 1 in 10,000 in that study.
1 in 10,000?
Yeah. That was to my study. Now, the numbers I come to here is what if I?
10 to minus 4 only?
Yeah, I come to that, of course. Obviously, the measured numbers on the real wild type pages is much larger than that, much more stable than that.
Right.
That's what I come to now when I go to this mainstream. So let's see how to relate to maintenance, where basically we should. That's a model I made with Jäger Well and Stanley Brown. So we just quantify what Tia and Akas Johnson did in the 80s. In terms of chemical kinetics, and then put noise over it, and then see whether this model makes sense in a realistic setting. And the model is this OR1, OR2, OR3, this crew on this side, C1 on this side, come with refinements later. This is the basic model. Akas has measured crew binding to all these sides. Actually, he measured and remeasured them again 2 years ago in some paper where he has it with one decimal place, about three significant numbers. I don't know how much that means. So he has a binding of everything to everything here. He has coke binding there, C1 binding there. Coke binds strongest to that, C1 to that. There's a story about cooperativity. There's additional little story about cooperativity between coke molecules also, which was not known earlier. It's not so much. It's of course done in vitro. Yes. So one has all these bindings, and it's all fine. And we're going to use these bindings. That gives you some information about at any C1 number and any CO number you just put in your statistical mechanical counting. It's kind of trivial. You just count the probability to be in any state. Let's say we have a CO here and a C1 dimer here. And then we count the free energy for this state with a crow dimer here, C1 dimer here, and whatever concentration is out there, assign that the statistical weight of that. And then we do that for all different possible combinations of crow and C1. And actually, there could be an RNA polymerase there, which is also known as binding. We put all this stuff in. All these bindings are known. What is not known in this model it basically is that this crow and C1 are DNA binding proteins, specific, but also unspecific. So there's a parameter for this, both CRO and C1, that they are binding all over the DNA. And that's not measured at all. Yeah?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So as each of this, you can generate curves like this. Some kind of typical, so a typical response. Curve you get is something like so this is a kind of typical curve you get for something like, I think he has, and there's a number like 11.5 or 12.5 kilocalories per mole.
No, concentration.
Certain nanomolar free concentration. It's Hawley McClure's own study. But this is not an essential parameter. It can be whatever that. That's not. What is essential parameter is how much C1 bind unspecifically and how much CO bind unspecifically. Because that is, even if I know the C1 number in the cell, which I basically do, it's reasonably well known, somehow it's 300 to 400 in a cell. What I don't know is if it binds with more or less than something like, if it binds with less than 2 kilocalories per mole per base pair, somehow in
average, then it doesn't matter, because then it should be the C1 with the floating in the center. If it binds more, it matters a lot, because it basically can do the C1 concentration.
Once these things bind, do they produce more C1 or C1? Is that an output being conjugated?
Yes, that is what you use all this chemistry to do. So you don't do the chemistry just for doing it. You have to, in a given configuration here, like Co and C1 and an RNAP here, well, then you count how often you have an RNAP here. The fraction of time you have there, that's proportional to how much C1 you get out. And that's where you put in some production dynamics into it. So that's basically what's plotted down there. So I just jumped over all this trivial modeling. So this is the average activity of this here as function of C1 concentration, given that co-concentration was set to zero. So that's how the profile of this side would be. Four. So you see that if you have no C1, you have no, essentially we have very little production of PIM. And that was because there's no C1 here, there's no stimulation between these two. So that means that this here is firing at a lower rate. That you have to put in that number also. Well, that's well measured. The production rate of C1. DC1 DT. So that would be the vertical axis, and you put it proportional to this. And then it depends on, and you have to count all the states which is producing with the weight at which they are producing. Only dilution. So you can run this simulation in different ways. You can Langevin or Planck or a different thing, but basically you have a decay of C1 corresponding to cell division. Each time the cells grow, divide, it's half. Plus minus the fluctuation of square root of n.
Some people want to measure the UVS times, and then you want to do the directly induced
rate as an additional thing. That could be. Yeah, that would be
but
if
but
you want to. Which is not the case for Crow. So for the Crow, you have a little addition of decay rate, which is a little bit unknown. It's kind of like between half hour and 1 hour. Anyway, this parameter is not that essential. It's because it's still the overall parameter that matters is really how much Cro binds to unspecifically to the DNA. If it binds a lot unspecifically to DNA, Cro will not come very much here, and the system will be very stable. If on the other hand, Cro does not bind at all unspecifically to DNA, you cannot stabilize the system at all. It's simply Cro will always take over, and the system will go a little. So there is a parameter, there's a balance, there's a parameter of unspecific binding of both sides that's not measured. For the unspecific binding on one side, there is some measurements. Indirect measurements, there's measurements of basically how fast the rate is here as function of concentration of C1. Because people have actually measured that by putting a reporter gene out here and counting how much is produced as function of C1. And what you're doing by changing the unspecific C1 binding, one are basically kind of stretching this axis more or less, so one are tilting it here. So one can have some control on the unspecific C1 binding by this way.
Do we know the unspecific binding as opposed to just other
unspecific
thing? Binding sites?
This is an average. It's an average measurement of all kind of stuff that happen everywhere else on the DNA. If it's just a few sites, this is absolutely
300 irrelevant Cro-like binding sites, which are perfectly specific.
Could very well be, yes.
Just making a difference.
Yeah.
In case, we don't need to measure anything in addition, right? All we need is
if it's only
Cro-like genome. Count up plausible
if they are then having more free energy, then contribute more than all the less
on a system distribution of on specific, as a more specific. Yeah, absolutely, you could do that. Absolutely, of course. Yeah, I don't know anything about it, so I sum up and have to have a parameter which counts. This anything that is more or less specific is kind of like a sink that is a parameterized as just unspecific unknown
just
binding.
Say, you know, there's specific binding and not specific
yeah.
binding. Sort of say,
yes.
Yes.
So specific is here and unspecific is everything else for this study.
So I'm just saying, that's specific, that's not possible.
Yeah. 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 Then there would be a transition at 300, and there would be a sharp transition at 300. There could absolutely be some saturation effects that I don't include. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think that was one of these numbers that I don't think we should put. I could give you a higher number. Nobody has no. I don't think no. There's no. Actually, Co is not a very well characterized in the. Nobody really knows how much Co there is in the cell. Everybody says there's essentially zero, but that's just something that people say.
Other than you know, this binding site that there's
operator left, which is basically right. Having the same as this.
Yeah. And otherwise, then that would be running out of.
To my knowledge.
No, but there are lots of relevant models on pseudo types. Just some similarity.
Yeah.
Right, but this is a very little, I mean, number binding.